Welcome, everybody. Thank you very much for coming out. It's so exciting to see such a large crowd for Ellen. And I really, for those of you who don't know her personally or haven't had a chance to take a look at the book, I really hope you will after hearing the talk tonight, because her book is really delightful and fascinating story. My name is Andrew Yetman. I'm one of the booksellers here at Politics and Prose. And before we get started with the actual event, I just wanted to see, I don't think there are any seats available, but if there's anything available next to you, if you could raise your hand. We do have two audience microphones on either side here, so when it's time for the question and answer session, we hope you will use the microphone so that everybody can hear you. We also record our talks. If you have not had the opportunity to listen to a talk that's occurred in the past, you're welcome to visit our website and follow the links to our archive. We try to keep that updated. We're generally about 2 weeks behind schedule, but you can find previous talks as well as this one will be posted in the future. When we finish the talk, if you don't mind just setting your chairs to the side, it'll help the flow of the crowd. Ellen will sign books afterwards. They're available for sale in the very front of the store. And if you can line up to my left, to your right, she'll be happy to oblige you with a signature and a bit of conversation afterwards. Finally, if you haven't already signed up for our email contact list, we encourage you to do so at the information desk so you can stay informed about talks like this in the future. And I believe Ellen also has a contact list that she would like you to, if you'd like to stay informed about events that she's hosting or participating in, you can add your email to that as well. So, thank you again for coming. We always are very gratified to see a large crowd at the bookstore, especially for our local authors. And Ellen has done an extraordinary job in documenting both her personal story and the history of the Lithuanian Holocaust and the people who either lived through that or suffered from it. She has previously published in a number of publications, Hadassah, The Forward, Shofar, Bridges, and so she's very accomplished. But I was particularly struck by, as she explored her personal journey, this and her desire to learn about the language, about the language that her mother, her grandmother, her ancestors spoke, Yiddish. She returned to Vilnius and became open to the oral tradition and the history that she didn't know much about. Her uncle provided a link, and it just began to open a whole world, which, if you read the book, you'll be exposed to. It's profound. It's touching. It's thoroughly engaging. I was reminded of Everything is Illuminated by Jonathan Safran Foer, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with, just because of the personal nature that touched onto history and began to explore politics, both then and now. It was a key. Her exploration for her personal journey was a key that opened up a much larger world, and by sharing that with us, it's been a great opportunity to learn. I really welcome you, Ellen, and I'm glad that you have this book published. We are here, Memories of the Lithuanian Holocaust. Thank you for coming to share with us.
Thanks, Andrew. It's really an honor to be here at this much beloved cultural institution. Good evening. A good novent. A good novent. I went to Lithuania to connect myself with my roots, the Jewish ones, that is, on my mother's side. My father's side is not Jewish and has to do with Ireland, which is where the name Cassidy comes from, in case you were wondering. But my journey into the old Jewish heartland ended up taking me far beyond Yiddish and far beyond my own family story, and became an exploration that changed my view of the past, of the future, and changed me. Here's how it began with Yiddish. And this is from the book. A soft summer rain was falling as a white-haired woman made her way to the microphone. Taira Talmidim, she began. Dear students, through the pattering of drops on my umbrella, I leaned forward to catch her words. The old woman's name was Bluma, a flowery name that matched her flowered dress. She was a member of the all-but-vanished Jewish community in Vilnius, Lithuania, the city once known as the Jerusalem of the North. How fortunate I am, she said in a quavering voice, to have lived long enough to see people coming back to Vilnius to study Yiddish. Unser Yiddish, unser Sprach, vermocht doch äußeres Gorasach. Our Yiddish, our language, possesses such a wealth of treasures. 75 of us, students of all ages from all over the world, huddled on the wooden benches clustered together on wet cobblestones. Around us, the damp walls of Vilnius University rose into the heavens. As the rain continued to fall, I shivered. It was a complicated place, this land of my ancestors, a place where Jewish culture had once flourished, and a place where Jews had been annihilated on a massive scale. Now, when my mother was alive, I could count on her to keep hold of the past. But after she died about 20 years ago, those who had gone before seemed to be kind of slipping out of reach, and I found myself missing the Yiddish words that she used to sprinkle into her conversation like a spice. So when I learned about the Summer Institute in Yiddish in Vilnius, I was eager to go. I wanted to immerse myself in Mama Lushan, the old Yiddish mother tongue. I wanted to walk the cobbled streets that my ancestors knew so well, the twisting lanes of the Jewish quarter that used to be just agog with crowds and political and intellectual ferment, synagogues, libraries, and newspapers. I wanted to breathe in the summer light of the Baltic sky, to fill my eyes with the ochre-colored wooden houses, the marigolds spilling out into the yards, the fields and barns where my great-grandmother, Asna, worked on a dairy farm, and the road that is still called Synagogue Street, where my great-grandfather, David Michel, used to pore over the Talmud. Now, mind you, at that point, I barely knew where Lithuania was. I had to get out an atlas to find out that it is the most southern of the three Baltic republics, with Latvia and Estonia on top and Poland underneath. It was a republic of the Soviet Union from the end of World War II until 1991. Geographically, it's the size of Maine, and the population is 3.5 million, about the size of Connecticut. But one thing I did know was that Lithuania had a notorious Holocaust history. I knew that in 1941, when the German army invaded, the Jews of Lithuania were massacred with a swiftness and thoroughness that was unusual even for that time. It was the German invaders who issued the orders, but in most cases it was Lithuanians who pulled the trigger. And I knew that hundreds of Lithuanian towns have their pit in the forest, not far from the market square, where Jews were assembled, shot, and hastily buried in mass graves. I knew that during the war, in the three major Lithuanian cities, tens of thousands of Jews, including some of my own relatives, were confined in ghettos, and some were forced to work as slave laborers. Most were eventually killed. By the end of the war, only 6% of Lithuania's 240,000 Jews remained alive, and today only 4,000 Jews live in Lithuania. But I also learned that there is another history of suffering in Lithuania. At the end of World War II, the Nazi retreat did not bring peace to the Baltics. As the three nations were incorporated into the Soviet Union, it was not an easy transition. A bloody resistance struggle went on for years. Tens of thousands of Lithuanians were deported to Siberia, men, women, and children. And as time went on, half a century under two different regimes, created a cauldron boiling and bubbling with competing martyrdoms, hatreds, and resentments. Investigating that cauldron became the heart of my stay in Lithuania and the heart of my book. To give you a taste of what I found, let me take you to dinner on a beautiful evening soon after I arrived in Vilnius. And this again is from the book. Waving at me from an outdoor restaurant across Castle Street was Violetta, a middle-aged woman with a broad, fair face and blonde hair, her solid body squeezed into a tight, fashionable jacket and matching skirt. We sat down at a checkered tablecloth and ordered a decidedly un-Jewish meal of shrimp salad, then raised our wine glasses. L'chaim, I said, offering the traditional Jewish toast to life. Sveikata, she responded in Lithuanian, to health. A friend back home had connected me to Violetta, who was neither Jewish nor a professional history confronter, just an ordinary citizen, and I'd written and asked if she would talk to me about how her country was exploring its 20th century history, especially the Jewish tragedy, and she'd responded warmly, eager to help. I took out my notebook. Growing up in the Soviet era, I asked, what did you learn about the Jews during the war? She squeezed her eyes shut and furrowed her brow. We knew about Auschwitz and Buchenwald, she said. We learned in school that many Jews died. Did you learn about the pits in the forest? I made a digging motion with my hand, where the Jews were shot and buried, the mass graves. Yes, she said, she had learned about this too. She looked away, then met my eyes. But, she said, no one taught us in school how many Lithuanians were sent to Siberia by the Soviet power in 1940 and 1941 and also after the war. Pregnant women and children, they died in Siberia. Her voice grew louder. Many Jews were involved in the Soviet system, she said heatedly. Many Jews worked in the KGB. The Jews were the ones who sent my people to Siberia. I looked around at the nearby tables where other city residents were talking and eating. No doubt some of them were also seething with such feelings. I too was seething, I found. I didn't like hearing the massacre of my people placed side by side with the suffering of hers. I hated hearing my people blamed for the suffering of hers. She sliced the air with her hand. I want to say, she declared, that the Lithuanian people through all of history have loved other nationalities. Jewish people, Russian people, Polish people. She paused. That is, normal Lithuanian people loved others. The local men who helped round up Jews in 1941 were not normal people. But, she said, every nationality has some like this, some abnormal people. Lithuanians as a whole should not be blamed for the actions of a few. After a moment, her face changed. I would like you to meet my mother, she said. I will take you to her apartment in my childhood town of Kadaini. Kadaini was not far from Sholé, where members of my family had been confined in the ghetto. I had family near there, I said, in Sholé. You have? Violetta asked. You have family in Sholé? I did, I said. They are there now? No, they were there. They are? They were, I repeated. She looked confused. But they are not there now. No, I said. Of course they aren't there now, I wanted to say or scream. They were Jews. The Jews were killed or sent to concentration camps. Don't you understand? Was it just a grammar problem? Past tense, present tense? Or was Violetta simply unaware of the sheer magnitude of the Jewish annihilation? Did she not know that only a tiny percentage of the pre-war Jewish community had survived? I looked at my watch and stood up. Violetta rose with me, and we shook hands. When we visit my mother, she said, she will tell you how my family rescued Jews during the war. My mouth opened in amazement. As we parted, I realized that what had happened with Violetta was, in a way, exactly what I was hoping for. I wanted to allow disparate voices to swirl around me, to lose my balance, to let the confusion build, to gather information in bits and pieces without trying to decide right away what it all meant, to recognize that the path ahead would be full of twists and turns without trying to avoid the bumps and the jolts. I would go visit her mother, I decided. Well, I did meet Violetta's mother, and it was an eye-opening experience, as was my experience in Rokiškis, my ancestral shtetl, or small town, in the northeast corner of Lithuania, where a museum curator told me there was an old man in town who wanted to meet with a Jew before he died. In 1941, as a boy of 17, this man had watched as the Jews of Rokiškis, including some of my distant relatives, were assembled in a field and driven into the forest to be shot. That knowledge had tormented him all his life. He wanted to tell what he knew, and he wanted a Jew to listen to his tale. Would I be that Jew? Well, I have to say, I was not eager to be that Jew. But I did agree to talk with this man, and what happened when I did profoundly changed my view of bystanders, rescuers, and victims. Further exploring the cauldron that is Lithuania, I'll give you just a few very brief stops on my journey. I visited the Holocaust Museum in Vilnius, and then on the other side of town, I visited another place called the Museum of Genocide Victims, which is not about the Holocaust. It's about Lithuanian suffering under the Soviets. I visited a place called Tuskulienė, an old estate in the middle of Vilnius. In 1994, hundreds of bodies were discovered under the green lawn of this estate. And forensic analysis determined that they were the remains of people who had been executed by Soviet authorities right after World War II. So here it is, 1994, right after Lithuania won their independence, and people were hungry to grieve over their mistreatment during the Soviet times and to commemorate the fallen. So planning for a monument at the site got underway that would honor Lithuania's suffering and resistance to Stalinist oppression. But then a painful truth emerged. It turned out that many of the bodies, hundreds in fact, were those of Nazi collaborators who had helped to massacre Jews in 1941, and that's why they had been shot. Construction of the monument came to a halt, and a fierce debate began over what to do with the bodies and the site. It was not possible to divide the bones into two neat piles, Lithuanian patriots here, murderers of Jews there. So Tuskulienė became a very complicated site, with the eerie name of the Park of Quiet. I visited the Lithuanian archives to research the Cholet ghetto, where my uncle Will and other family members were confined under very harsh conditions before being sent on to Stutthof and Dachau. What I found out about that ghetto was gruesome and it was troubling, but part of what was troubling was what I learned about what my uncle had done in the ghetto. And this led me into a moral questioning that I don't think I will ever be done with. It was not difficult to find anti-Semitism in Lithuania. I saw swastikas spray-painted on Jewish gravestones. But finally, what gave me hope, even in this fraught terrain, were the brave souls, the activists and educators I spent many hours talking to, Jews and non-Jews. They are working to create a new public discourse, to bring the Holocaust out into the open, including the Lithuanian role in it, and to find ways to process the Soviet experience. These people, these activists, are reaching out and searching for ways toward mutual understanding, seeking to transform their country, in their words, from a society of bystanders to an active civil society. And these brave people educated me, they inspired me, and they turned my visit to Lithuania into not only a journey of return, but also an encounter with the future. Through their example, I came to ask myself, and I ask you, can we honor our diverse heritages without perpetrating the fears and hatreds of the past? Can we make the effort to listen, to open our minds and our hearts? And these are the questions that Lithuanians today are being asked, questions that I think we all need to ask ourselves, whether about a place like Lithuania or about other lands scarred by conflict, I can think of a few, about our own country and even our own personal lives. Let me conclude by taking you back to that rainy courtyard on my first evening in Vilnius, where the heavy Baltic sky grew darker and the rain began to fall harder. The white-haired woman in the flowered dress stepped away from the dais, and the director of the Yiddish program took her place. Dressed in a white linen shirt and a black jacket with an antique cut, he looked as if he'd stepped out of a bygone era as he combed his fingers through longish black hair and then gripped the podium. "We are about to travel back in time," he said. "I invite you to taste the borscht, the herring, and the latkes. Taste this long tradition. We will plumb the riches of Yiddish poetry and prose," he said. "We will study the styles of writing, meditation, and understanding that flowered in this part of the world. And we will touch on terrible destruction." Suddenly, a great black cawing thundercloud of crows filled the heavens. All of us, students and white-haired Bluma and the Vilnius residents who had come to welcome us, peered up into the drizzle. Harsh cries echoed off stone walls. The director, too, looked up. He waited until the birds were gone and the sky was blank. "You must listen to the silences as well as to the sounds," he said. Thank you.
So I do encourage you, if you have any questions, to please approach one of the microphones. And we'll have a short period of questions and answers.
Thank you for your very poignant discussion of the situation in Lithuania. I was always struck by the ferocity with which the Jews were annihilated in Lithuania. Mm-hmm. You didn't touch upon that very much in your presentation, mm-hmm. but I was wondering if you could give a sense of why it is or why it was that this happened there and not mm-hmm. other places. I mean, other places were pretty grim, too, but yeah. there's a whole range of how the local population collaborated with the Nazis. And if you could just elaborate on that, what you learned of why this was particularly horrific in Lithuania. Thank you.
Yeah, so the question is, why was it so, was the Holocaust so horrendous in Lithuania particularly? Historians have been thinking that through for decades, and I don't know if they will ever really get it, come up with really an answer that satisfies everybody. There are a number of things we can point to. One is that before the German army invaded in June of 41, back in 1939, the Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union had signed a non-aggression pact, including a side agreement called the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, which I heard about every 5 minutes in Lithuania. And this had its secret aspects, too, and it allowed the Soviet Union to take over the Baltics, to bring Red Army troops in. And not only did they bring the troops in to hold the Germans back, which I believe was a good thing to do, they also went about a thorough revolution in those countries, where whoever was high became low and who was low became high, and the whole country was just tossed upside down in a very aggressive way. Many of the intelligentsia, the elite of Lithuania at that moment, were packed off to Siberia with their families. A knock in the middle of the night, they had 10 minutes to pack, and they were gone. And that bred a certain amount of resentment. Also, the Nazis were busy showering the Baltics with very, very intense anti-Jewish propaganda. At the same time, when the new Soviet society was set up, Jews who had not been in the government to this point, which was basically a fascist government, suddenly Jews were in positions of authority, and people thought, what are they doing here? They must be at the heart of this. Even though the Jews were only quite a small minority of who was in power, they were so visible. So these are some of the things that people have pointed to. Another thing I think is, you know, people sometimes say Lithuanians and Poles and Jews and Russians and Germans all got along so well in Lithuania up to that moment. Jews had been in Lithuania for hundreds of years. And it is true that there were basically not pogroms, but on the other hand, there was a real alienation where people didn't mix much. They didn't fraternize much. They felt separate. They felt that they were the Jews were the other, according to Lithuanians. So once everything got thrown up in this kind of liminal state, there was a fertile field there for hostility that had been kind of simmering below the surface for a long time. These are just some of the reasons. It's awful. It's awful to contemplate, and I know that there's almost nothing that can be said about. There's certainly no excuses, and these are the kinds of things that Lithuanians today are thinking through or pondering. How did this happen in our country? How can we make sure this never happens again?
I'm one of the small number of actual Lithuanians here in the audience.
Welcome.
Thank you very much for a very good presentation. Just a little personal note. I was certified three generations back on both my mother's and father's side to emigrate to the Third Reich, that I have no Jewish heritage, so I'm certified by the Third Reich as being Judenrein. Thank you very much. Having said that, my grandmother is on the Yad Vashem wall, and I had the opportunity to publicly support the case for accountability in the Lithuanian community, and also publicly work with the Office of Special Investigations to help put a number of people who participated in that out of the country. And I would like to just, all I came here to say is I would like to apologize on behalf of my people for what we did. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
I made the film Partisans of Vilna, so if you want to know all the inside awful story, I would suggest, they're supposed to have been putting it out, but you can order it or get Politics and Prose to order it. But I think another thing that was happening in 1941 is the Nazis had not perfected the concentration camps, but they had perfected, you know, to root Judenfree their territories. So they came in with the Eisenstadtgruppen. So they were both Nazis, but as one of the most poignant lines in the film is, and the Lithuanians greeted them with flowers, which has to do with a lot of the politics you've laid out. But one thing I think we should be very proud of, there was a unified resistance among the Jews and with fellow Lithuanians. So it always came down on political lines. Mm-hmm. And I think as a I came from a mixed marriage, Polish-Lithuanian Jewish family. And one thing my dad always said, that the Lithuanian Yiddish was the best, the Litvak Yiddish. Unfortunately, he only taught me how to swear, but I guess I swear well. Or with good. But seriously, what's fascinating to me is that my understanding, we couldn't film when we were making the film because the Soviets were still in control, and I took the film years later, actually when the Soviets were surrounding Vilna. Now, I always refer to it as Vilna because that's the Yiddish pronunciation. That's not what you're going to see on the map. But what's fascinating to me is my understanding since I've been there and from knowing that they show it is there's a Jewish museum in Vilna. And also, is there a roots gathering? Because, you know, this is really happening in Poland where all of a sudden a lot of people are realizing they're Jewish. I mean, do you find your counterparts now in Lithuania?
My counterparts?
Finding roots, trying to find roots of people realizing they were Jewish.
Yeah, that phenomenon of Poles sort of embracing their own Jewish selves, their, you know, genetic selves, as well as the Jewish culture. I don't think that's happening as much in Lithuania. I know that that's that yearning for sort of getting back what was lost during the Holocaust and feeling it as a very personal loss, that it's not just something that happened to other people, but it happened to us. This was taken away from us. I know that is definitely in Lithuania. Right. Yeah.
I guess I'm an authentic Litvak, both on my mother's side and my father's side.
Okay.
So, and I think the speaker who preceded me was Aviva Kempner.
Yes, Aviva Kempner is the filmmaker.
Yes, and I want everyone to know and pay honor for the work that she has done in bringing forth the ghetto and the work that happened. The two questions I wanted to ask you, sort of related. One is, did you undertake this as a kind of personal pilgrimage, or did you go with a group? And second of all, is the government of Lithuania doing anything to promote the kind of return or connection or even support for the Jewish community in Lithuania? By the way, I'm from Kovno Gubernium, but that's okay. We love the Vilnius, too.
I'm from Kovno Gubernia too. So.
Oh, maybe we're related.
Yeah, we probably are. I originally went to Lithuania with a group of my husband's relatives, some of whom are here tonight. But I know there are. And then I went back and signed up for the Yiddish school. So, and that I was part of that group. But there are many ways to go. The government of Lithuania, like other governments, has its various sides. And I would say that some parts of the government have been justly criticized for being too slow to prosecute Nazi collaborators and instead have gone after some really courageous Jewish partisans on grounds of war crimes. But other parts of the government really are putting Holocaust education into the schools and are really, there's some fascinating things going on there. With people being urged, students talking to their grandparents and great-grandparents about the old Jewish days and encouraging conversations to take place. So there is a lot going on there.
Okay.
Yes.
My grandparents came from South Russia, Poland, places like that. I was wondering if you could, you mentioned that after you talked to the elderly Lithuanian, you had different ideas about bystanders. I was wondering if you could talk a little about that.
So what happened when I talked to this elderly bystander? Well, the first thing I want to say is you have to read the book, right? But to give it away a little bit, first of all, it was hard for me to step across this cultural divide and shake this man's hand, someone who I had thought of as one of them, you know, a bystander, someone who had stood by indifferently while my people were taken away to be killed. And I saw some more texture there. I saw what he had gone through. One thing I saw was that he had been deeply scarred by being forced to watch other people be mistreated. And that is a special kind of trauma that I had not known about before. And that's really something. And I made myself, a lot of what happens in the book is I say, okay, so I'm on this side. What if I were on this side? So what is this person thinking? And for example, in the encounter with Violetta, I felt how bad it felt to have her saying to me, you're the ones who did it to my people. And basically that's sort of the mindset that I had gone to Lithuania in. You guys did it to my people. So there's a lot of that kind of thing that happened with that man. And I started to think that using terms like the bystanders, the Lithuanians, they, we can do better.
Yeah. First of all, congratulations on your book. It's so thoughtful and unique, really, because it's easy to just take sides, and it's harder to, painful to go where you went. But that's not my question. My question has to do with the Yiddish and the Yiddish program, but in how it connects to this larger issue of patrimony, because there's something weird going on, and I don't understand it, but it's part of what you're talking about, because there is a younger generation now that is not shaped the way the older generations were and really belong to a different mindset and are trying to understand and come to terms and figure out who they are and how they are in relation to others and belonging to the European Union and more travel. So I did teach at the Yiddish program in Lithuania a few years back, and it was a powerful experience. In my beginning Yiddish class, I had 14 students from 11 different countries, and most of them were not Jews. Some of my colleagues were not Jews, and I would kind of laugh because they were talking about how you celebrate Christmas in your different countries, but in Yiddish, you know? While at the same time, most of my fellow Jews here are not interested in Yiddish, and and won't speak a word of it to anybody. And so I'm totally baffled. I'm baffled by what this all means. Like, what? How do you sort out the language from the religion and the peoplehood? And are people just confused as I am? Or
the world is a very strange place.
Okay, I guess that's my answer.
I don't know what else to say. But thank you for that contribution.
And we have here also a woman who has directed that program for a while, Tina Lunson.
Tina Lunson,
maybe
yes.
She has the answer.
Do you know, Tina, why it is that things are so weird? Yes.
Oh. I was one of the founders of the Yiddish Institute. Well, it was the summer program before it was the institute. And my purpose in being involved so deeply was because I traveled a lot to Lithuania also for research, and I found younger people, young meaning born well after the war, who spoke this perfect Kovne Yiddish from birth. They should be teachers. All of these people should not be hidden away anymore in Lithuania. They should be teaching. They should be spreading what they know. So that was part of my reason for being involved. So a lot of the students are Lithuanians. They're Jews and non-Jews. And the students who come from other places, especially in Europe, many of them are doing research in their own countries. And they feel that they must have Yiddish in order to understand some facet of their own culture. Mm-hmm. Because the Jews are gone, but that piece is missing, and the only way they will find it is going the original route through Yiddish. And that's what that interest is largely about.
Really a precious legacy. Yes.
Oops. My name is Victor Miller. Just a comment, first of all, just a piece of information. JewishGen.org is a website which focuses on the genealogy of Jews from different parts of the world. There is a Litvak Sig, so if you go in on jewishgen.org, there's no fee to join or anything like that, and it's a very active interest group that's ongoing. I myself are of South African origin. Most of the Jews that live in South Africa today and have been for quite a while are of Litvak origin. And I'm just curious if I've heard a lot about the Institute. What was your experience like, and would you recommend it? This is the first time I've come across folks from the Institute. I've just known about it, and probably will go on it next year, but I don't know anything about it.
So the Vilnius Yiddish Institute, it was just fantastic. It was the experience of a lifetime. It was just great. There was a lot of focus on grammar. Got to be ready for that. There was tons of homework. And then in the afternoons, the last Yiddish speakers of Vilna would take us on these tours into pre-war and wartime Vilna and point out where they had been and what they had done and what this building used to be. And you know, there are traces of the Jewish world all around, but you need somebody to show them to you. And it was just, it was a fantastic experience.
Thank you.
You talked about the individual activists that are trying to change the culture in Lithuania. I'm wondering whether there really are official bodies or official organizations, part of the Jewish community, part of the Lithuanian government, who are actively promoting it, subsidizing it, supporting it, so that they can find a new direction and realize that they have to repent for the past.
Yeah, the Lithuanian government has there's a something called the International Commission to research both the Nazi times and the Soviet times, and I met with people who design curricula, Holocaust curricula, for students of all ages. The government supported and the Jewish community to run this program where these two people would get in a truck and drive all around the country, which doesn't take that long, actually, stopping at villages and towns, and they jump out of the truck and set up this series of panels talking about Jewish history, and then run workshops and seminars and music evenings and so on about the Jewish past. And they said that this created the most attended museum, visitorship attendance of the whole year. People had never met a Jew. They were curious. Tell us, this woman said to me, people came up to her and said, show me a real living Jew. Yeah. You know, I mean, and actually I made an analogy to the United States and the Native American population here where, you know, at first I would walk down a street that was called Jewish Street or Synagogue Street, and I would think, how callous. How could people be like, I'll meet you on Synagogue Street in half an hour? How could they do that? And then I thought about the Potomac, Tacoma Park, the Chesapeake. Half of our states are named with Indian names. And the rivers, the mountains, the streams, the lakes, it's all around us. And we know about it. I'm sure we all think we know. But there's a way in which we don't really know. And that helped me to understand some of what's happening in Lithuania today. Yes?
Hi. One of the earlier comments seemed to imply that the vicious anti-Semitism was unique to Lithuania. It certainly was there, and even before, as you noted, before the Germans, as soon as they crossed the border, before they had a chance to organize, there was vicious killing. There's a very notorious picture from Kovno around this garage where smiling Lithuanians are killing Jews. It was similar in Latvia. Ukraine supplied most of the guards for concentration camps. I mean, we could go on. In Poland, after the war, and when Jews returned, there were pogroms. And I mean, I visited the shtetl where my grandparents were from, and now it's in Belarus, and spoke to people. The Germans were there. They were sitting on the side drinking schnapps. The locals were doing the killing. So it was diffuse, certainly in Eastern Europe.
Yes, I agree. And then the question is, here it is, 2012, and what do we do with that information? Never forget, but how do we remember, and what do we remember, and what do we do with that?
Yeah. Ellen, you produced a film, you write books. What's next, a musical? my question is a distillation with the last gentleman asked. You talked about the political dimensions of the genocidal actions against the Jews. How much of the religious part, the Christ killer part, might have been a component of this then? Is there any discussion of it now? I know the religion has been a bit deracinated because of the Soviet era, but any thoughts on that?
Yeah, so to what extent does religion play into anti-Semitism in Lithuania and what happened there? I know that just about all of Lithuania is Catholic. And some years ago, about, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, the Catholic bishops of Lithuania issued a proclamation in which they apologized for the actions and inactions of some officials of the church, priests and so on. There were priests who distinguished themselves by their bravery and their rescue actions. And then there were those who did not, who didn't speak up, who were in a position of leadership and could have used their power to say, let's behave humanely, and did not. So it's a complicated thing. That's all I can say. Yes?
Could you please speak more about the Soviet deportation of Jewish families from Lithuania to Siberia, if you know the numbers, and if it would have been a common practice for Jewish and Lithuanian, non-Jewish Lithuanians to be deported together to Siberia?
Jews were deported to Siberia. They were a minority of those deported, but they were definitely deported, and thousands of them. I don't know the number. Yes, they were transported together. I think the Soviet power was in a hurry, as often in Soviet history. They came in and they needed to sort of stabilize the region immediately. And they kind of went around and kind of with a big dragnet and picked up whoever, people who spoke Esperanto were special targets. Bundists, Zionists, anybody who, you know, it's funny, it was anybody who sort of had a mind of their own that might not have necessarily welcomed this new order. And the result was that a lot of people who could think for themselves and who would have perhaps been able to take some leadership were not there when it came time to do that.
So. I just wanted to add to that. To give you a story of the Soviet purges, this is 1937, what happened to my grandmother's cousin. Someone tipped him off that he was in Minsk, Communist Party official, and someone tipped him off that he was on the list to be arrested. So he got out of town for a week. And the way it worked, they had a quota, like everything in Russia, they had a quota. So if they couldn't find the person on their list, they arrested somebody else. So you could come back the next week, go back to your job as if nothing happened, and that's what happened to him, and then got arrested in 51.
Okay. Yes?
Everyone, a lot of other people have talked about their ethnic heritage. I'm Irish, so. I was wondering how the Holocaust overshadowed your childhood or was dealt with in your childhood.
How did the Holocaust affect my childhood? I think I was in my 30s when I really started to engage with the Holocaust. And at that point, I was astounded that I was in my 30s before I did. That's another thing that helped me understand Lithuania. I had read Anne Frank's diary. I had grown up with my uncle and knew that he'd been in a ghetto and had been in a concentration camp. I knew his stories of heroism and so on. It was right there in front of my face, and yet I found when I was in my 30s and starting to think about how did this happen, why did this happen, that I was asking those questions for the first time. So it's often been said that that both in the West and in the Soviet Union, right after the war, there was a period of memorializing and commemorating, and then there was a period of what they call latency, where from about 1950 through the early 60s, there wasn't that much discussion of it. Again, it was right there in front of everyone's face, but it was not really part of the public discourse. And then, as we know, in the West, it definitely became part of one, and it's right in front of your face now. It's impossible not to know about it. But for those 10 years, which is when I was in my, you know, youngest consciousness, It was not out there much. Again, this was true in Europe. It was true in the United States. It was true in the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union, it would come up, it would go back down again, it would come up, it would go back down again. And I would say it never did, during the period of the Soviet Union, come back out really fully into public view. Yes.
Yeah, follow on the South African comment. When you're in South Africa, it's sort of startling how obvious the Jewish community there is predominantly from Lithuania. Mm-hmm. What were the socio-political economic conditions in Lithuania between 1900 and 1930 when those people chose to go there? Was there any difference between Lithuania and any of the other Baltic states at that moment for this to have happened?
Between the wars in Lithuania, Lithuania had been part of Russia up through World War I, and then in 1918, they became, for the first time in many, many years, an independent country. Lithuania used to be a gigantic country. It was huge. It covered from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea, and it was part of a Polish Commonwealth, and and this is a dangerous thing, it had a heroic past, a giant heroic past that was lost. And that's a bad thing for a nation to have. So in 1918, they became independent, and it took a few years, but by 1924, they were on this sort of up with Lithuanians thing, and they started to pass a lot of laws, such as stores. The Jews had been the middle class in Lithuania up to that point. Now, all stores had to be open on Saturdays, for example. All business had to be conducted in Lithuanian. It was kind of a affirmative action for Lithuanians who had not been part of the middle class. And so Jews started getting squeezed out. My own uncle, Shia, left Lithuania in 1924, and there was a giant rush of middle-class Jews down to South Africa. I don't know the answers to your other questions, what happened in the other Baltic states, and what was going on in South Africa itself at that point. But there's a lot, like Nadine Gordimer and those people, they all have Lithuanian background, too.
Yeah. I'll just say the answer to the question about South Africa, let me answer it in one word, gold.
Gold. There's your answer. Okay. Okay.
Is there anybody else? I don't want to squeeze anybody out because there's a lot of people here, but
I have one more thing to say.
I do want to just thank Ellen for coming. Have some final words.
Yes, I have some final words. Okay.
Please buy her book.
Okay. I want you to know that the book is going to be published in Lithuanian in May, which is good. And this Thursday, March 22nd, I will be speaking at the Lithuanian Embassy at 6:30, and I'll be showing slides and talking more about my uncle and the bystander, that gentleman. And the educational initiatives and so on. And you can find out more about that on my website, which is the address of which is right here on this thing. And now I'd like to say, a gute Nacht. Let's hear it. Okay, thank you.